Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. This week on the programme, the police act to stop interception of their frequencies with scanners, satellite problems in Japan, and we look at DBS in the United States. Computers keep watch at the hospital bedside, and radio news, the world's tallest aerial mast collapses, more about digital audio broadcasting, and other radio stories from around the world. It's Sparks, keeping you up to date with the latest media news, science, and technology.
In Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies a rich lady who's crying over the luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathize with her, but he thinks that he should warn her that the third world is just around the corner. In the Soviet Union, a scientist is blinded by the resumption of nuclear testing, and he is reminded that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer's optimism fell. In the cheese pavilion, and the only noise I hear is the sound of someone stacking chairs and mopping up spilled beer, and someone asking questions and basking in the light at the fame-filled minutes of the fanzine writer. Mixing pop and politics, he asks me what the use is. I offer him embarrassment and my usual excuses, while looking down the corridor out to where the van is waiting. I'm looking for the Great Leap Forward. Jumble sales are organised and pamphlets have been posted. Even after closing time, there's still parties to be hosted. You can be active with the activists or sleeping with the sleepers, while you're waiting for the Great Leap Forward. Ah, one leap forward, two leaps back. Will politics get me in a sack? Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. Well, here comes the future and you can't run from it. If you've got a blacklist, I want to be on it. Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. It's a mighty long way down rock and roll from top of the pops to drawing a thumb when you're watching the Great Leap Forward. If no one out there understands, just start your own revolution and cut out the middle man. The Great Leap Forward. A perfect world with all singing tune, but this is reality, skip some love. The Great Leap Forward.
And now to WFRL for a juicy piece of information.
Arch's World of Radio, the poor man's media network.
A mystery surrounds the test transmissions taking place on 6305 kHz under the name of Harmony Radio. Yes, I've just done a piece about that, didn't I? A number of well-known voices have been heard identifying the station, which has been playing a selection of easy listening music. Radio testing. The owner of the US address announced in the broadcast that the Enterpriser John England has been involved in a number of radio projects in the early 80s. It is understood the tests, which are believed to be coming from Ireland, will be continuing for some weeks to come.
It's Archer's World of Radio.
So, we obviously need to get out the archive tapes for Tower Radio. We'll see what we can find for a future radio archive programme then. Via West North Kent Radio there, that was WFRL on 6275.
Here's an interesting snippet. Electronics and computer manufacturers are apparently leading the rest of the engineering sector in a slow recovery out of the recession, according to the Engineering Employers Federation's autumn survey. Sales of electronic goods and computers at constant purchasing power are forecast to grow by 5.2% in the first half of 1991. A letter here from Phil Burbles, Rockville, Maryland, in the United States. He's got an ICF 2010 with a 4-metre dipole at 45 feet. It's the second time he's heard us. The first time was on 12255, and he's now writing a report for 6205. Very interesting show you had tonight. A lot of variety, not just back-to-back music. You're the third Euro pirate I've heard. I've also heard World Mission Radio and Radio Stella. Unfortunately, none of the Euros have much of a signal here. I don't know if many of the pirates in England have been busted, but in the United States quite a few have been given fines of $1,000. So over here most of the pirates have quite short broadcasts, only a half hour or so. I'm 20 years old and a student at the local college. I enjoy listening to the pirates and have worked to get a radio ticket. I also like to do a bit of woodworking in my spare time. That's Phil Burbles in Rockville, Maryland, the United States. And your letter could be next to be read out. The address? Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply in writing, which includes a station card, some technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. The address? Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. And you could contribute to our Pirate Radio listing feature. Every week we try and read out someone's report of what they've been listening to on medium wave, shortwave and FM. So when you're listening around, keep a log for us, and we'd appreciate your own contribution to this program.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Let's see.
BBC praises HF broadcasting. An article by John Tusser, Managing Director of BBC World Service, in Radio World. Is the landscape in which the BBC World Service operates changing radically or at all? My observations are not in any sense conclusions, merely notes on the position which we now find ourselves, technically and theoretically speaking. We at the BBC expect that HF broadcasting will be the leading element in our delivery mix for the next decade. It is there, listeners know about it, governments can't stop it, and it has done a good job. And if it did not exist, I rather suspect that somebody would invent it. Too often we overlook the extraordinary range and facility provided by HF. We, all of us, spend too much time making old-fashioned jokes about the poor quality of shortwave. I have often heard it as good as medium wave, and neglect to emphasise the size of the footprint, and the fact that HF often has three footprints. This makes it a giant in seven league boots as a delivery system. And what about the convenience of HF to the listener? Today, sophisticated receivers can be as small as a cigarette packet, or no larger than an envelope. At the flick of a switch, you have the world at your fingertips. Years ago, it was said that the trouble with the book of matches was that it was invented before the cigarette lighter. Had it come afterwards, it would surely have been hailed as neat, convenient, portable, accessible, and easily replaceable. Because HF is a mature technology, that does not make it an obsolete one. BBC's World Service is diversifying means of delivery fast, from our own medium wave transmitters where it is appropriate, Cyprus into the Arab world, Lesotho into South Africa, Masira into the subcontinent of India. But the fastest development in the last 3 years has been the rebroadcasting of satellite-delivered signals by a local FM station. It gives us immediate, good-quality contact with an audience that HF cannot give. FM rebroadcasting is a growing local supplement to HF, though with a very small footprint. In the further horizon, we are watching DBRS and the debate about single sideband delivery, not to forget WARC 93 with close attention. On the possibility of introducing single sideband, I must refer to some very recent BBC research on the subject in India and Sri Lanka. India is a country with a huge population, a very high radio set ownership, a receiver base of which two-thirds of the sets are less than 5 years old. This is a market where even those classified as very poor buy radio sets, and a market where one-third of radio owners would be ready to pay approximately $130 for a radio set which met all their requirements. So far, so good. When questioned further, no respondent said they would change their receiver in order to get single sideband reception. The conclusions of this BBC survey are as follows. The introduction of single sideband transmissions will cause a disintegration of the audience for the programmes of BBC World Service and other international broadcasters. It is in the interests of neither the broadcaster nor the listener in the developing world to propose the early introduction of single sideband. We must not run ahead of audience awareness and audience demand. Finally, a word about definitions and categories. Too often in the past, the activity that many international broadcasters engage in has been described by its best-known method of delivery, shortwave. As these methods diversify, this description becomes misleading and obsolete. As shorthand, shortwave is useless. Too often, still, another erroneous assumption is made. Because many international broadcasters are publicly funded, they are described as being merely part of the government information and diplomatic machine. This, too, is fallacious and unreliable. It is to categorise by funding. I categorise by function. International radio is a type of broadcasting with a particular agenda for a particular audience. world news for a global audience. We have all heard of community radio, local radio, network radio. Welcome to the wonderful world of international radio. We will not get it right if you imprison us in the wrong categories. I conclude by summing up. We take nothing for granted, even in an environment which in Britain is currently friendly to the idea of journalistically independent international broadcasting and the BBC World Service as a practitioner of it. Demonstrating impact, effectiveness, and value for money will constitute an essential part of our case for continuing to exist. That piece by John Tusser, Managing Director of BBC World Service.
Enjoy this trip. Enjoy this trip. And it is a trip.
Countdown is progressing.
Oh, no.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts every Monday and Tuesday. And fresh Radio Facts programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. Police act to foil radio interception in Electronics Times. England and Wales 43 police forces are set to buy voice scramblers or secure speech units to prevent criminals intercepting radio messages. With more than 125,000 police in the regions, orders could run into several million pounds. Trials are underway and details should be issued next year, according to a spokesman of the Association of Chief Police Officers. Senior police officers have been worried for some time that criminals have escaped justice by monitoring radio transmissions on scanner radios, which are widely available in high street stores. Regional crime squads which deal with serious crime are already equipped with £1,000 secure speech units, but officers on the beat are more likely to be equipped with cheaper scrambler systems costing between £200 and £500. Cheap VHF and UHF scanners are available in high street stores for as little as £20, according to this report. The Wireless and Telegraphy Act forbids scanners from being used to monitor police broadcasts, but owning a scanner is not illegal. Each police force will buy its own equipment, according to the ACPO spokesman, but commonality will be needed if officers from different forces are to talk to each other. It will be a bolt-on solution, not withdrawal and replacement of existing sets, but every base station, vehicle radio and probably handheld set will require protection. Here's some shortwave news sent in by Alan Dean from Burnley in Lancashire. In Argentina, RAE has English to Europe from 1900 hours to 2000 hours on 15345. Radio Merlin state they hope to increase power on 6240 before Christmas and hope to have a long-wave transmitter on air before the end of the year. That's an interesting claim. Radio Harmony are still testing, but state they hope for regular programming to begin soon. There was, of course, a piece on that in the programme a few minutes ago. Radio Mutiny, a UK station heard on 6210 and using the QTH of postbox 220342, 5600, Wuppertal 22 in Germany. News from Taiwan. The Voice of Free China has English to Europe from 2200 hours to 2300 hours on 9852. 11915 also via WYFR transmitters in the United States. In the USSR, as was one of the new Soviet stations, Echo of Moscow is now operating between 4 and 7 o'clock in the morning and 1600 hours to 2000 hours on 6165. It's a poor frequency choice, as it's used regularly by SBC in Switzerland. Reports can be sent to the station at UL Nikolskaya 7, Moscow, 103012 in the USSR. I'll have to listen out for that one myself. In Yugoslavia, English from Radio Belgrade is now on the air as follows. 2.30 in the morning on 9555, 11885. At 12.30, 17740, 17710, 21605, and at 19.30 and 2200 hours on 6100, 15140. Radio Zagreb operates throughout the day on shortwave 7240 and 9830, in addition to 11.34. English news is featured at 8.35 in the morning, 12 o'clock, and 21.03. 9830 is also audible here during the day, and 11.34 can be heard after dark. Thank you very much to Alan Dean for sending that in.
What's that? Body heat. What's that? Gotta go to church, y'all. 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 And you got to turn on heat, take off that pressure. Turn on heat, take off that pressure. Turn on heat, take off that pressure. Turn on the heat, take off that pressure. Give me some air, I can't go nowhere. Can't go to church, y'all. I'm having bad luck. I'm having bad luck. I'm having bad luck. Got to release the buck. I'm having bad luck. I'm having bad luck. Got to release the buck. Gotta go to church, y'all. Gotta go to church, y'all. Gotta go to church, y'all. Take me when I was a little boy. My days one. My mother told me I'd be loving son of a gun. When I was a little boy, my days two. Check myself. Something I had to do when I was a little boy. Don't want nobody bothering me. When I found a little boy, about 84, back up, I had to check myself. Won't give me some more. Tell me, gonna go to touch y'all. Tell me, gonna go to touch y'all. Cut off the heat, take off that pressure. Cut off the heat, take off that fresh air. Give me some air, can't go nowhere. Shucks. Give me some air, can't go nowhere. I'm having bad luck, I'm having bad luck. I got the heat, I said I got the heat to fuck. I'm having bad luck, cut off the heat. Can I get the friends? Yeah, fellas, I need it.
In the Independent, the waves are humming with Mr. Maker's tune. Steve Clark meets the man likely to launch Britain's first national commercial radio station. David Maker, once described as British commercial radio's first millionaire, casts a disgusted eye over the executive furniture. He is in the boardroom of Jazz FM, the troubled London radio station he is trying to take over with his partner, David Astor. They will soon know whether they have succeeded with their £1.3 million bid to run the Jazz service, believed to be losing £100,000 a month. They are also raising £6 million to launch Classic FM, British radio's first national commercial station. The licence for the United Kingdom's first independent national radio station fell into Mr. Maker's hands after Showtime Radio, which had outbid Classic FM, failed to come up with the money in time. If Mr. Maker and Mr. Astor also fail to find the cash, the licence will go to a consortium supported by Lord Hanson. If Mr. Maker's attempt to take full control of Jazz FM succeeds, he intends to run Classic FM from the Jazz station's tiny London headquarters near Marble Arch. He plans a total staff of about 40, which he says is two-thirds the number originally employed by Jazz FM when the operation was launched into a recession 18 months ago. His new company, Golden Rose Broadcasting, has raised about £750,000 in loans, and he maintains he now has a 30% irrevocable stake in Jazz FM. Mr. Maker's return to prominence in Britain's brittle commercial radio industry comes after a period in the wilderness. His idea for a commercial station devoted to classical music, competing with Radio 3, goes back to 1986. However, it was not until the late 80s that he had a chance to turn his idea into reality, when the Independent Broadcasting Authority offered three new licences for themed music stations in London. Classic FM, supported by Andrei Previn and Kirita Kanawa, was widely tipped to pick up one of these licences, but the first went to Jazz FM. Subsequently, the group was again beaten by Melody and Kiss. Now, Mr. Maker is convinced that Radio 3 is ripe for the taking. Radio 3 is appealing to a very elitist audience. It is fatally flawed in its funding, he says. As a licence fee payer, I object to Radio 3 being given £44 million a year, most of which goes on promenade concerts, composers and orchestras. I am not paying my licence money for somebody to be given a mini-arts council operating from Broadcasting House. It gives it the power to virtually ignore the audience and do what it likes. Ironically, it was the BBC that gave Mr. Maker, now 51, his first job in radio as a news producer when it set up Radio Merseyside in the early 70s. He had left school at 15 and joined the Liverpool Daily Post as a copy boy. He trained as a reporter with the Bootle Times and, after national service, worked for the Birmingham Post. He now owns a substantial detached Victorian house in Formby, where he grew up. His business and management skills began to emerge when he was with the group that successfully applied to run Liverpool's first commercial radio station, Radio City, launched in 1974. But it was running Red Rose Radio in Preston, and the company's policy of taking over other ailing stations that established Mr. Maker's reputation as one of the most dynamic figures in British commercial radio. During the 80s, Red Rose acquired control of Radio Air in Leeds, Gwent Area Broadcasting in Newport, and CBC in Cardiff. My team pioneered multi-radio station management. We were the first people to persuade the Independent Broadcasting Authority to take over a bankrupt radio station, he recalls. When Mr. Maker left Red Rose in 1988 after a row with Owen Oyston, the chairman, he took about £1 million in cash with him. I'm one of the very few people who've done well out of radio. I don't deny it. David Maker is one of a handful of commercial radio managers who know what radio's about, says an admirer. He's not an inveterate small businessman. However, Mr. Maker has drawn criticism for his willingness to sacrifice a station's original programme brief in order to capture audiences and advertisers. Buzz FM, the Birmingham station that Mr. Maker took over last November, is no longer wholly devoted to playing the predominantly black music it had promised when it won the license. But Mr. Maker is unrepentant. It's not a black music station. I make no apologies for that. It's there to serve the city of Birmingham. There are also fears about what Mr. Maker will do to Jazz FM if, as seems likely, he gains complete control of the station. Since the service was relaunched in the spring, its programming has lent increasingly towards the middle of the road, and a further lurch towards blandness seems inevitable. Two of Jazz FM's specialist presenters, Chris Phillips and Jez Nelson, have departed. David Maker knows nothing about jazz. He doesn't know who Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie are, claims one of his detractors. Mr. Maker acknowledges his ignorance. Indeed, he admits he could think of nothing worse than spending a night out at Ronnie Scott's jazz club. But, he says, the promise of performance, the musical formula agreed by contract with the Radio Authority for Jazz FM, is quite wide. It says you can play jazz, soul, or rhythm and blues, or any music influenced by jazz. Apart from Mozart, it's anything really. He adds, This radio station needs management that understands radio, and it needs an instant way of making these palatial premises work. Jazz will be a money spinner, there's no question about that. And even more important, it will be a good radio station. I want Jazz FM to please people like me. Mr. Maker's programme plans for Classic FM, which should be on air next summer, are also certain to be controversial. The idea is to play musical pieces up to 5 minutes long between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m, interspersed with news, traffic, weather and sport. Complete symphonies and concertos, including live performances, which will be sponsored, will be reserved for the evening. Mr. Maker intends to spend £2 million on Classic FM's programme budget. Radio 3 listeners dip in and out. We want to keep our audience, and we will adopt a warmer, more friendly style. We don't want presenters reading the sleeve notes. They don't actually have to be experts on classical music. That piece by Steve Clark in The Independent, and it was followed in the letters column by a letter from Paul Brown, Deputy Chief Executive of the Radio Authority, who was challenging the quote about the promise of performance, where Paul Brown says, "The promise of performance forms part of Jazz FM's license with the Radio Authority. It allows the licensee to play, quote, jazz, soul, or rhythm and blues, or any music influenced by jazz. Apart from Mozart, it's anything really. This is incorrect. As a prospective purchaser of Jazz FM, Mr. Maker and his employees have discussed with the Radio Authority the music he wishes to broadcast. We are content with the proposals made so far, in that while they concentrate on shorter pieces of music, under 5 minutes duration, and tend to avoid jazz music that might be inaccessible to all but the keenest buff, they offer nonetheless a fair spread of the music mentioned in the Jazz FM promise of performance, without concentrating particularly on any one aspect. In the words of the promise of performance, jazz music defined in its widest sense, quote, if planned playlist changes proceed, we expect to hear a balanced blend of vocal and instrumental jazz, contemporary, cocktail and mainstream, plus blues, soul and rhythm and blues music in any 3 hour listening period. This blend may alter occasionally in off-peak periods when one or other particular aspect of jazz music is highlighted. But I hope this letter clarifies the situation. Jazz FM must remain a jazz station or give up its license." That's from Paul Brown of the Radio Authority. David Maker himself has a letter published in The Independent where he also tries to tone down his quoted statement about playing anything apart from Mozart. And he ends his letter with, "Any suggestion that Madonna will be heard on 102.2 FM should be scotched forthwith."
Thank you.
listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. In this week's programme, the police act to stop interception of their frequencies with scanners, satellite problems in Japan and DBS in the United States, computers keep watch at the hospital bedside, the world's tallest aerial mast collapses, and other radio news from around the world. A short here. Michael Fabricant, co-founder and director of MBI Broadcast Systems, who make mixing consoles, has been selected as the Conservative Party prospective parliamentary candidate for the constituency of Mid Staffordshire. A short piece from Electronics Weekly. A remote control that needs just 3 keystrokes to program a VCR to record Coronation Street is being launched on 6th of December. Trevor will be pleased. Rescuing the 70% of video cassette recorder owners who have problems programming their machines. To record goings-on in the street or any other program, of course, owners of the £60 Video Plus handset need only type in the code number printed in TV listings magazines or newspapers and press a button to say whether it is to be recorded once, every week, or daily. Each code, up to 8 digits long, generates a unique combination of date, start time, channel, and length of recording. The more popular the program, the shorter the code. A factory-set clock in the handset sends an infrared signal to the VCR 1 minute before the program is due to begin, telling it to start recording the selected channel. The TV Times, Daily Mirror, Today, and The Times are among the publications which will publish the codes, which are generated by a board plugged into the publisher's typesetting computers. On to a shortwave and FM pirate listing sent in by Tom Reed. We haven't had one for a while, so I'll go through the lot for any new listeners. 6205, of course, Radio Facts. 6210, Radio Mutiny International. 6218, Radio Mutiny International, heard again. 6220, Radio Zenith International. 6229, Jolly Roger Radio. Also 6229, Southern Music Radio via JRR. Also Radio London and also Radio Europe have been heard on that frequency. 6230, Britain Radio International. 6240, Merlin International. 6240, also Weekend Music Radio. 6255, Radio Confusion. 6262, Northern Ireland Relay Service, and Riverside 101 have been heard on that, as well as European Pirate Radio. 6275, West and North Kent Radio, WNKR. 6276, Radio Delta Elburg. 6280, Ozone Radio. 6285, Radio East Coast Holland. 6290, Radio Orion. 6293, Radio Stella International. 6300, Radio Confusion. 6305, Radio Harmony. 6524, Radio Pamela Shortwave. 6538, Station Sierra Sierra. 7446, Radio Stella International. And FM, this is in the Northwest, 98.5 Classic Hits in Dublin, 100 Kiss FM from Liverpool, 100.7 Hot 100 in Rhyl, 101 Choice FM in Liverpool, 101 PCRL in Wolverhampton, 101 Unity Radio in Manchester, 101.5 Radio Mersey Waves in Wallasey. They've also been heard on 101.7. I suspect that that's their transmitter drifting. 104.25 Rock 104 Dublin, and finally Medium Wave. 1350 North Coast Radio from Birkenhead. 1609 Radio Barones, Holland. 1610 Radio Perlay International in Holland. Radio Mersey Waves have been on 1610. And he's heard an unidentified station on 1615 kHz. He also reports Radio Barones on 1621.
Years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalized in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie.
Jackie. Jackie.
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
Take away.
The other day, Paul read out from the Book of Wonders of the World something about the highest aerial mast in the world. Well, Paul, you can cross it out. It's fallen down. The tallest aerial in the world of Polish Radio's long-wave transmitter site has collapsed. Intensive investigation has started to find out why the world tallest structure, Polish Radio's aerial mast in Gabin, northwest of Warsaw, collapsed without causing any casualties, but only material losses, on the 8th of August. The 646-metre-high mast was used to broadcast programmes of Polish Radio Channel 1 on 225 kHz. The accident happened after specialised teams changed the steel guy ropes. On Polish television, they reported that causes for the collapse of the radio mast in Konstantaniaw near Gabin, as well as future possibilities for the transmission of the first programme of Polish Radio for Poland and abroad, will be investigated by a special commission set up by the Ministry of Communications, the owner of the mast. Representatives of different ministries, radio and television affairs committees, and the Polish posts, telegraphs and telephone will sit on the commission. The Warsaw Central Radio Station was commissioned in July 1974, following 4 years of construction. The former radio station in Razin was thus relieved, and since then, the first programme of Polish radio became audible also in Western Europe and in the Middle East. The new mast had been, until its collapse, the tallest construction in the world, recorded in the Guinness Book of Records. It was 646 metres high and weighed 1,100 tonnes. The mast collapsed on the 8th of August, and the fire which broke out was immediately extinguished by three units of the fire brigade. Initial assessment of the material losses amounted to about 1 billion zlotys. At the moment, the first programme of Polish radio is audible only within Polish territory, because the range of the standby radio station in Razin, which took over from the Gabin station, is four times lower. The Minister of Communications has said that the mast, possibly a shorter one, will be rebuilt in the same place. It will probably be a cheaper project than dismantling the remaining equipment at Konstantaniaw. Well, I think, Andy, that it fell down in sympathy with the tallest ship-borne aerial mast on the Ross Revenge falling down 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, it must have been situated on a black ley line. New Scientist reports, computers keep watch at the bedside. Critically ill patients at Southampton General Hospital are helping to test a computer program which could make nurses' lives less stressful. The Equipment Monitor program, which won £50,000 of government funding last week, monitors the equipment connected to the patient by means of a neural network. Equipment Monitor is a neural network program which, like the human brain, takes decisions by weighing up information it receives, in this case from the equipment. Patients in the intensive care unit at the hospital are connected to conventional equipment, which monitors their heart rate, blood pressure, respiration rate, and other functions. While the nurses watch the equipment as usual, Equipment Monitor is watching too. If the program proves a success, it could eventually take over this task completely, freeing the nurses to look after patients in other ways. The monitor can learn by updating the emphasis it places on the various types of information. The neural network in the Southampton trial is learning, under supervision, how to spot when a patient needs attention. But, unusually for such a program, it does this during non-emergency periods and infers from that what constitutes an emergency. Most neural networks have to experience an emergency before they can recognize one. Lorraine Dodd of Neural Solutions in Cheltenham, who is developing the equipment monitor with her colleague Nigel Dodd, says, "We don't want to put a patient through trauma just to train the machine." She suggests that this type of training, called default training, might also be useful in nuclear reactors and chemical plants, where accidents have serious consequences. Mick Nielsen, the consultant in charge of the intensive care unit, says that the programme could make the jobs of nursing staff easier. Theirs is a very stressful job, to look after the patients and be alert to changes in their condition. To know there is a box monitoring them too will help remove one element of the stress. Dodd goes further. No machine will ever be able to do the horrid bits of medicine, she says, but this will allow nurses to do the real nursing care rather than sitting watching screens for hours. The programme could also monitor patients under anaesthetic in the operating theatre. Nielsen and the team at Neural Solutions will analyse data collected during the trial, which began 2 weeks ago, to improve the neural network. So far, all the patients tested have been stable, but Nielsen says that when the programme did set off the alarm, it was the appropriate times. Equipment Monitor has some similarities with expert systems, which store large quantities of information gathered by human experts and select and supply them to anyone who needs help with making decisions. In an expert systems, rules have to be stated explicitly. For example, if the heart rate exceeds a certain value, sound the alarm. But in Equipment Monitor, the relationship between the items of information is different. Neural networks build up their own rules during the learning process. That report from New Scientist.
We rarely hear about problems the Japanese face. So we're suppressing a grin. Japan facing satellite problems from Asia Pacific Broadcasting. About the Japanese satellite broadcasting industry, which now depends entirely on the dying BS-3A satellite after two failed attempts at launching backup satellites. Japan's fledgling satellite broadcasting industry will have its credibility very much on the line when the BS-3B is launched from Tanegashima Space Center in southern Japan this autumn. On the surface, things seem to be going fine. The age of satellite broadcasting in Japan commenced in January 84 with the launching of the BS-2A satellite. After the 1986 launching of the BS-2B, NHK started to broadcast on two satellite channels. In July 87, it started 24-hour programming on one of the channels. As of January 89, 1.32 million households were receiving satellite broadcasting, and by the end of March this year, the number of subscribers had risen to over 4 million. Each subscriber pays $65 a month. The launching of the BS-3A enabled a new commercial venture, the Japanese Satellite Broadcasting, to launch its WowWow channel, which currently offers 24 hours of programming, including 18 hours of scrambled programs. At the beginning of March this year, JSB had received 340,000 applications from subscribers. The commencement of operations by the BS-3A also led to the start of satellite digital audio broadcasting by Satellite Digital Audio Broadcasting Inc. from last November. Assuming the BS-3B can be put into operation on schedule, a separate high-definition television channel will also be started in the autumn. And there are ambitious plans afoot for PCM radio broadcasts and data broadcasting. However, behind the scenes, satellite broadcasting in Japan has been plagued by launching disasters and breakdowns, so that, despite the frantic efforts of all concerned, it has been walking a tightrope without a safety net for most of its existence. When the BS-2A went out of service prematurely in 1986, NHK was faced with the prospect of having no backup until the launching of the BS-3A late last year. Unfortunately, it can take years to build a satellite and to arrange its launching. But the lack of backup was not the only problem. BS-2B was also experiencing technical difficulties. NHK decided it needed another satellite as quickly as possible and rushed an order for what it called the BS-2X from RSA Satellite Corporation of the USA. Originally scheduled to be launched in December 89, it was destroyed when the Ariane rocket carrying it exploded on takeoff in February 1990. Also destroyed in that explosion was the Superbird B communications satellite of Space Communications Corporation. While the BS-3A was successfully launched on its Japanese-built H-1 rocket, another backup satellite ordered at short notice from the United States, the BS-3H, was blown up on April the 18th, together with its General Dynamics Corporation's launch vehicle. The situation is very grave, said the Minister for Posts and Telecommunications on the release of the news of that disaster. The BS-3A has three transponders, just enough for the two NHK and one JSB satellite channels. The failure of the BS-3H left the aging BS-2B reaching the end of its life as the only backup for the BS-3A. The BS-3A itself has never been trouble-free. It suffered a short circuit in one of its power cells last year, and this March its solar cells were damaged by unexpectedly strong solar radiation. At about the same time, one of the three transponders went out of operation. NHK officials at first insisted that JSB's WowWow should move to the BS-2B, as NHK had an obligation to serve remote parts of the country where normal services were poor. However, in the end, NHK was obliged to move its Channel 11 partly because JSB would have had to buy new receiving equipment. The BS2B was to have reached the end of its six-year lifespan in February. After mid-June, it was predicted that the quality of its transmissions, especially to the more remote parts of Japan, would decrease. It was finally decided that from July the 1st, BS2B could no longer be used. A plan has been drawn up for WowWow and NHK Channel 11 to share one transponder on BS3A, while NHK Channel 7, NHK's main satellite channel, would take the other transponder. NHK's Channel 11 would be cut to just 8 hours a day of programming, while WowWow would broadcast for the other 16 hours. BS3A will remain operational before the next successful satellite launching, but should anything happen to the two transponders on the BCS3A, NHK and JSB subscribers could face severe disruption of service, and the companies themselves considerable embarrassment and loss of face. "It's a very dangerous situation," said Matsumoto Oda, JSB's PR manager. Disastrous launchings and technical breakdowns are not the only major problems facing satellite broadcasters in Japan. Another threat comes from the communications satellite industry, where operators and their clients are eyeing satellite television broadcasting as a major potential source of revenue. Somehow, that piece from Asia Pacific Broadcasting makes the fiasco in Britain of BSB and Sky not seem quite so bad after all.
And in the United States, SkyPix, headquartered in Kent, plans to begin service in late summer 1991 from the Hughes SBS-6 satellite, implying an all-digital system with 54-to-1 digital compression, 10 medium-power 41-watt Q-band transponders on the spacecraft, will beam 80 channels of programming to SkyPix subscribers at a nominal EIRP of 46 dBW over most densely populated areas. At 80 channels, the clear leader in quantity, SkyPix's initial offerings will include up to 200 movies a day and some home shopping programming. Sports are scheduled to be added later. All movies will be on a pay-per-view basis, with charges based on new or old classic classifications. Eventually, an optional package including some super stations and services such as a weather channel will be offered at a fixed monthly charge estimated at around $12. The set-top receiver connects to SkyPix via modem and phone line and is an important link in the billing, as well as in the channel selection process. Its billing involvement begins with the subscriber selecting the total amount expected to be spent monthly on pay-per-view offerings and fixed price option packages, and having that amount programmed into the receiver. It then records selections and costs of paid programs, reduces the available credit in the account, and reports the total expense for each month to SkyPix when polled by the central office. Billing via credit card account and restoration of available credit in the receiver to its original level occurs monthly. If programmed credit is exhausted during a month, additional credit can be arranged by phone. The SkyPix spokesman indicates that its distributor organization is in place and there is already a great deal of advance interest. Company expectations are for 600,000 to 800,000 within 6 to 8 months after the initiation of the service. From Howard I. Elowitz, writing in Microwave Journal.
Cappello di paglia? Quanto costa questo cappello di paglia? Cappello di paglia, paglia, di paglia, lo di paglia. Death and sex.
right side and there's two on the left. She said I was possessed. Went to a doctor, just gave me some tests. You know, he showed me some ink blots, look just like a hornet's nest. They
now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D, test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen, Tony Prince in 1966, other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s, and you'll hear too memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, P.O. Box 53121 at 1007 RC, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, P.O. Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.
in Asia-Pacific Broadcasting, a single standard for digital audio broadcasting by Michael Fiesel. The march towards a Europe-North America agreement on a worldwide standard for digital audio broadcasting has been derailed, at least temporarily. Disorganisation among European manufacturers may mean some delay in the launch of interference-free CD-quality radio services in North America and other parts of the world. In addition, officials in Europe and America had believed that the agreement of two of the leading blocs in the International Telecommunications Union would have given the European Eureka 147 standard a major boost in setting the DAB standard for Asia, Africa, and the rest of the world. The United States National Association of Broadcasters, which represents virtually every television and radio station in the country, had signed a letter of intent backing the DAB standard developed by the European Community's Eureka program. Eureka has 38 European member countries. In return for the backing, the agreement would accord NAB the right to collect license fees from anyone using Eureka DAB in the United States and possibly in other parts of the world. However, signing the final contract did not turn out to be a mere formality. The letter of intent expired this spring, and no meetings are scheduled to either extend it or to sign the final contracts. NAB Executive Vice President John Abel, who spearheaded the NAB effort, said prospects for restarting the joint venture are fairly minimal until Eureka decides what it wants to do. Eureka is still interested in doing a deal with the National Association of Broadcasters, although its rights to worldwide license fees may no longer be on the table. The NAB Eureka deal would have an impact far outside the United States. Among other things, it would almost certainly mean that negotiators from all over North America would join Europeans in proposing the Eureka DAB standard at the ITU's World Administrative Radio Conference, WARC. The conference will be held from February the 3rd to March the 5th in 1992 in Spain. Among other things, the WARC is scheduled to set worldwide frequencies for DAB. The heads of the Mexican Association of Broadcasters and the Canadian Association of Broadcasters have already said that they will endorse Eureka at the WARC. NAB backing would not guarantee that the US would support Eureka at WARC, but the Federal Communications Commission has seldom rejected proposals that are unanimously supported by the broadcasters, unless they have another powerful constituency, such as telephone companies or the Hollywood studios. The United States State Department, which will formalize the final United States position for WARC, usually defers to the FCC on technical issues like deciding which DAB system is superior. United States broadcasters seem to love the idea of DAB, which was unanimously endorsed by the NAB board. One advantage is lower power levels, which reduces both interference and operating costs. Eureka officials, for example, say a 100-watt DAB station would have the same service area as a 50,000-watt FM station. The lower electrical consumption alone would cut a station's power bills from around $6,000 per month to around $15 per month. The NAB wants the FCC to give existing broadcasters access to the spectrum between 1 GHz and 2 GHz, probably in L-band, 1500 megs. That would mean that every existing FM radio station and possibly all AM stations would be allowed to start a digital audio broadcast channel. The NAB says terrestrial delivery will ensure low receiver costs and the preservation of the cherished principle of localism, which assures that programming and news will be tailored to a particular city. One alternative to the Eureka system of terrestrial DAB that is being widely suggested for the United States is delivering DAB directly to listeners by satellite. The NAB has actively opposed satellite digital audio broadcasting, saying it wastes scarce spectrum and would result in only a few persons owning all DAB stations. Satellite DAB would also cut advertising revenues of local radio stations by 20%. Two different satellite DAB systems have been proposed. The first, Radio Satellite Corporation, said it could start services in 1993 when the L-band American Mobile Satellite Corporation satellite is launched. The Californian firm says it would provide 10 channels of CD quality radio, as well as two-way cellular type communications, paging, and even navigation services. These services would be provided through a link to the Global Positioning System satellites. Some of the RSC equipment was demonstrated at the recent NAB convention in Las Vegas. Full capability receivers would cost approximately $500. The other system, Washington DC-based Satellite CD Radio, SCR, would start in 1994 when a dedicated satellite is launched. SCR's hybrid satellite terrestrial configuration would use 70 MHz of bandwidth to offer a total of 100 radio channels nationwide. In addition to 66 radio superstations that would broadcast a variety of music and entertainment formats nationwide, there would be up to 34 channels in each metropolitan area for localized DAB radio stations carrying local news and radio formats of special interest. SCR officials estimate receivers would cost around $200. There are other terrestrial DAB options. Strother Communications received FCC approval to test its proposed terrestrial DAB system on UHF television channels in Washington and Boston. Strother said it can provide full DAB service with 48 MHz of UHF bandwidth, but broadcasters opposing the plan say it will cause unacceptable interference with television. Meanwhile, CBS is working on its own terrestrial DAB system, though it is not yet ready to announce it. Officials predict up to a dozen other proposals will emerge in the next few months because of the rich potential DAB consumer market. Most officials believe NAB support of Eureka would make it more difficult for new systems to emerge. Stephen Forshay, vice president of Dolby Labs, told the FCC that DAB would create a new microelectronics market with potential sales of millions of car radios alone. That article about digital audio broadcasting from Asia Pacific Broadcasting.
Sparks This Week is presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. Here's a letter from Derby, from Alan Christie. He writes, "Enjoy your Sparks programme on Mondays on Radiofax. The signal here is generally good on my Sony 5900 shortwave receiver, even on its telescopic whip. Quite frankly, I think the Sony is better than the satellite receiver. I was interested in hearing letters from listeners who say they hear pirate stations in their area, particularly Birmingham, and they said they were all amateur outfits where the DJs talk all over the records. Well, here in Derby, we have an FM rock station called Power 99 on 99.2 MHz. They play a rock format with minimal chat. DJs include Mr. Fish, the Fat Controller, Curly Spencer, who I think was on Caroline in 1990, the Reverend Tiptoe Tony, and Andy Hull. They've just returned to the air after a break and are sounding better than ever. They play no soul-y stuff or pop and just concentrate on rock, classic gold and classic rock, like Zeppelin, Deep Purple and so forth, such as was on Caroline's late night service in May or June, before they closed. That's what made me think that Curly was maybe on the ship. They're on the air from 10 a.m. until 12 midnight on Sundays and are the best pirates I've heard. Even comparable with Alice's Restaurant, which was a London pirate 3 or 4 years ago, incidentally. Maybe I'll send you a tape of their broadcasts in the future, just to prove there's some decent stations on the air. Meanwhile, best wishes to all at Radiofax, and I know where Chrissy went. I've heard her on Gem AM from Nottingham. Well, of course, you know that. Thanks, Alan, for writing." And hello to Ruben Antonio Sagristani, who's our first listener from Argentina, in Cordoba to be exact. He listens on a Sony ICF 2010 with a 33-metre long wire aerial, and he's listening on 12255. You can write to Sparks. The address is Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.